Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think we probably still have some stragglers who will come in, and a lot of people are messed up by the rain, but I'm glad we got the hardy ones here right on time for what I hope will be an interesting session talking about the implications of the Indian elections as seen from Washington. Some of our events, we bring in guest stars from overseas. This time we are fielding three members of what you might call the home team. All of us have followed Indian politics and Indian foreign policy from various different incarnations for quite some time. And so we will give you some thoughts and then look forward to hearing from you. I'm Tasey Schaefer. For those of you who don't know me yet, I'm director of the South Asia program here. To my immediate left is Dr. Walter Anderson, who after many years in the State Department has become a professor at the School of Advanced International Studies, Johns Hopkins, just across town. And on the far left from our perspective, but I'm sure she wouldn't wish to be called far left in any sense, is Lisa Curtis, who also served in the U.S. government for a number of years. She was on the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and she is now at the Heritage Foundation. I start from the premise that the key issues for the United States in assessing the impact of the Indian elections are, first of all, what kind of government do they produce? Is it one that can confidently expect to serve out its term? How kind of structurally stable is it? Second, what kind of economic policies will it follow? Third, how will it deal with the defense issues that the United States and India have been increasingly active on? And fourth, what will be its foreign policy? And there's a special category there of how will it approach relations with Pakistan. And that's pretty much the order in which we're going to discuss things. I will ask Walter to start with the who's who and who's where in the election and the domestic picture. I will talk about economics and some general foreign policy issues, and Lisa will bat cleanup, and we'll talk about India-Pakistan relations, and then we will look forward to hearing from you. You've got a number of handouts at your place. The one that is unlabeled, but which I'm sure you recognized, is something that Walter will interpret for you. But basically, this is a which district voted how map of India. So, without further ado, Walter Anderson.
Thank you. Let me just say a few things about the map, because I'm actually not going to refer very much to it. We might in our Q's and A's. And if you look at the colors, and I did this very quickly from something else, and so the dark saffron is BJP. The lighter color, I don't know, how would you call that, mauve, is UPA or Congress. The left is dark red, and others are mainly regional parties are the blue. I'm not going to say very much, but if you compare this with a map of 2004, it isn't all that different. The parties have more or less kept their concentrations where they are, I think that's interesting. Okay, I've been asked to talk about the elections and the impact on domestic policies, and I think there are three points to be made here, three major points. One is I think that the size of the victory for the Congress Party gave it considerable room for maneuver, something it did not have in the last 5 years it was in power. Secondly, I don't think there will be any dramatic changes in policies. There will be incremental changes, and I think that's because of the ideological centrism of the Indian system and the Congress Party particularly, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. And thirdly, I think the Manmohan Singh government will continue his policy of incrementally drawing closer to the United States in strategic and security terms, as long as that doesn't undermine the basic foundation of Indian security policy, which is strategic autonomy. In short, there will be no military alliances, I will predict. I want to make four preliminary points and then talk briefly about what I think will be the main policy thrust of this administration. First of all, I think we need to be very cautious about discussing who voted for what party and for what reasons beyond the macro statistics which you see on this map. The answer to these more precise questions will require a kind of microanalysis that has not yet been done. It will take some time to do it. And when I say this, I'm reminded of a wonderful study made by Professor Stephen Wilkinson from the University of Chicago and his analysis of the 2004 elections, which he compared election statistics and attitudinal data. Contrary to early judgments in the press and by politicians, he found no valid correlations on such dichotomies as urban-rural, religious, non-religious, except for the communists, and rich-poor. Indeed, he discovered that the more religious voters in India, as measured by attendance at temples, were more likely to vote for the Congress Party than they were to vote for the Bharatiya Janata Party, often identified as a Hindu nationalist party. Nevertheless, politicians and pundits have come to conclusions already, as they did in 2004, on what got them the election, and those judgments, however right or wrong they might be, are likely to shape the policy agenda. My second preliminary point is that the strong Congress showing virtually eliminates the need to consult with partners in drawing up a minimum program, as was necessary for the Congress leadership in 2004. And they, when the United Progressive Front, led by the Congress, received only 218 of 543 seats, well short of a majority, 54 short of a majority, and they had to get outside support from the communists to stay in government. The Congress this time expanded its parliamentary membership from 148 to 206 seats of the 543, and with 55 allies came to 261, just 11 short of a majority, which they easily picked up from various independents who had won their elections. My third preliminary point is the Congress Party is fundamentally centrist in ideological orientation and has always been that way. This spills into the system an incremental quality and not dramatic new departures. This point was further confirmed in this election by the significant parliamentary losses of parties both to the left and to the right, and the Congress Party was the major beneficiary of those losses. One can see this ideological centrist orientation when you look, and I would suggest everyone should look, at the 2004 Common Minimum Program of the UPA with the Congress Election Manifesto in 2009, and they're both easily accessible on the Internet. The former is far more explicit in policy recommendations and more left of center than is the 2009 document. The 2009 manifesto, in fact, has a whole section trumpeting the party's centrism and is entitled The Middle Path, the Congress Way. And among the major balances mentioned, the following, I think, summarizes the contention, and it reads, it, the Congress Party, is a balance between the public sector and the private sector with an important role assigned to cooperatives and self-help groups. What does that mean? That means we're on all sides, and how we go will depend on circumstances. My fourth preliminary point is to identify people I think who will have a preeminent role in shaping the policy agenda, and they are, in my point of view, you may have disagreements, you may want to add to that, we can talk to this, but here's my list. At the top is Rahul Gandhi, the party general secretary, its most dynamic campaigner, and responsible for the now much-acclaimed go-it-alone strategy of the Congress Party in the elections. He is not, by choice, a member of the cabinet, which is probably wise, in my view. He says he wants to use his time to build up the party organization, and to this end, he's focused on bringing younger people into the party, which is probably wise politically, that younger people 70% of the population is 40 years or below, a goal that included the Congress Party nominating an unprecedented number of people 40 years and younger, 27 of them winning. He also enrolled over 1.5 million young people in the Youth Congress and plans to vastly expand that organization, seen as a vehicle to mobilize grassroots support for the party. Curiously, he's also put at the top of his agenda building the party's grassroots structure and encouraging an internal democratic process. This would be something relatively new for the Congress Party, which has been very much top-down. In doing this, he'd be reverting to the style of his great-grandfather, Jawaharlal Nehru, and perhaps his father, Rajiv Gandhi, had he lived, rather than his grandmother, Indira Gandhi, who both centralized the party and gutted its local leadership. In addition, he concentrated on issues relating to the youth and to the rural poor and has said many times that he'll focus on these two groups in the new government. Second in my list is Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. As an economist responsible for giving vigor to the economic reform program in the early 1990s, he will have an eye toward policies that will result in stepping up GDP growth rates, which he and others have said is a major objective of his new administration. The most recent estimate of GDP for 2008-2009 fiscal year is 6.7, down from the 9 percentage points of recent years and a benchmark he and others have set for the economy under his administration. The challenge, however, to this enhanced rate of growth is that he and others, and the next person I'm going to speak to, Sonia Gandhi, have argued that India was spared the worst of the global economic crisis by a regulatory system that helped insulate the Indian economy from the crisis. And because most of the country's investment came from local capital and most of its production was consumed locally, something they say that should not change. This further underscores the fact that further economic reform will be incremental and not dramatic. Third person is Sonia Gandhi, chair of the UPA, leader of the Congress Parliamentary Party. Sonia seems to be increasingly relying on the views of her son, who she is almost certainly grooming to be prime minister when he and she think he's ready for it. She repeats his emphasis on rural development and the youth. On economic matters, however, she tends to be a bit to the left of Rahul and the Prime Minister. She talks about economic growth with a human face, inclusive economic growth, often coupling this with support for various programs aimed at helping the poor, especially the rural poor. In a speech earlier this year, for example, she strongly defended the nationalization of the banking system. By the way, she gave the speech to a group of bankers, and the writer of the article said that there was sort of a white just went over their faces and kind of gasped as she talked. She said that the nationalization of the banking system by her mother-in-law, Indira Gandhi, was a move that guaranteed that capital was available to a much broader sector of the population, especially the rural poor. In short, it was a good thing to do. My next candidate for influentials in this administration is Pranab Mukherjee, the newly named finance minister, and this is the second time he's been finance minister. He's a grand old man of the Congress Party, having held almost every senior position in the government and the party. He's been Minister of Defense, External Affairs, head of the party in the Lok Sabha, head of the party in West Bengal, and perhaps its most effective troubleshooter dealing with allies in the first Manmohan Singh government. He has a reputation for caution and will steer the party in a gradual economic centrist direction, talked about by the party's big three, the Prime Minister, Rahul Gandhi, and Sonia Gandhi. An early sign of this caution regarding economic reform was reflected in the President's address to Parliament yesterday, when she asserted that the government will encourage private shares in public enterprise, but also insisting that government equity does not fall below 51%. The next one is P. Chidambaran, the reappointed Home Minister, a post he was given in the wake of November's terrorist attack on Mumbai. As one of the steps the Prime Minister Manmohan Singh took to dampen criticism of inadequate security arrangements in India. He was an astute choice to make for this troubled ministry, as he had the reputation of being among the most competent ministers in the government with a can-do reputation. As finance minister from 2004 to 2008, India had its highest GDP growth rates. He was also among the advocates of pushing the economic reform agenda, including, and he's talked about this recently as well, and so have others, meaning they'll likely happen, giving higher equity to foreign investors in insurance, opening up pension funds to private enterprise, and giving foreign banks enhanced voting rights in the banks where they have an equity. In addition, he's one of the handful of ministers close to Sonia Gandhi and could be relied upon to protect the family's interests, which is why he obviously got the post. His successor as finance minister, Pranab Mukherjee, is less evangelical in his views on economic reform and more likely to insist that economic growth is inclusive and with a human face. On specific issues, Rahul Gandhi and the other senior figures I mentioned above targeted two groups to build party support and attributed the party's relatively good showing in these last elections to the benefits that had been given to these two groups. One was the rural poor and the other is youth. The high cost of these programs contributed to the increased budget deficit, however, which presently stands at the very high figure of 11.9%, doubling what it was last year. Expansions of programs benefiting these two sets of the population will compete with the call of the Prime Minister and his new Finance Minister for higher expenditures for infrastructure and larger defense outlays. In my view, political considerations seem to favor programs to the rural poor and youth rather than infrastructure if it comes to a choice between those two sets. Let me say just a few things about the rural poor. Regarding the rural poor, the Congress Party in its election manifesto, and as I said, you should read that because it's really a fascinating document, well written, well put together, and I think will be implemented, put at the top of its list of achievements during 2004-2005 the National Employment Guarantee Act, whose objective is to provide 100 days of legally guaranteed employment, providing about 100 rupees a day to each rural household in public works programs. In 2006, this covered 330 of the country's districts, and the remaining 274 will be covered next year. It is estimated that 720 million of India's 1.2 billion people live in rural areas, and 400 million of them are poor. In families with incomes, that is, it's defined as less than 50 rupees a day. It's estimated that the cost of this program, when fully functioning, will be 400 to 500 billion rupees, about $10 billion, or somewhat about 2% of GDP, most of it coming from the central budget. About 57% of the recipients in the past year were scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, and one of the potential political benefits for the Congress Party might be putting together the old Congress alliance of urban high caste voters and rural scheduled caste voters, which propelled the Congress Party election after election to victory. Parallel to rural employment schemes is a large national program to train implementers, and the goal is to train some 620,000 people in 400,000 villages. And these implementers are very likely to be powerful sources of mobilization in the future. On youth, regarding potential programs of youth, I'd suggest that you all read the National Knowledge Commission, chaired by Sam Petroda, a highly successful IT entrepreneur who several of us around the room know well, who's also very close to Rahul Gandhi and Sonia Gandhi. His views count, and many of the Commission's recommendations are very likely to be adopted. At the top of its agenda is a proposal for legislation at the national level to affirm the right to education, which, as he notes, is a fundamental right mandated by Article 21A of the Indian Constitution. The bill would require Indian states who have the primary responsibility for education to pass laws within a certain time to guarantee education to every child. What's interesting about this is that the funding and oversight would be federal responsibilities, as would be norms for curriculum and teacher qualifications. I want to conclude with just a few words about external security, since I'm running out of time. First, on domestic security. In the wake of the Mumbai bombings, the Congress Party very quickly, in fact, almost with the speed of lightning by Indian legislative standards, put together a new law that's called the National Investigative Agency Bill and Unlawful Activities Preventive Act. Now, if you remember that, it's even hard to sort of read from my document here. That's right. Sort of thing I ask my students at class, see if they remember it. This received assent from all the parties in the country. What's interesting about this particular bill is it's even tougher than the earlier Prevention of Terrorism Act so-called POTA, which was dropped by the UPA government soon after coming into power because of violations of human rights. Included in the new law that repeats the old one is the use of wiretap evidence, information as evidence, stringent bail conditions, even increasing the 90 days of detention without bail in POTA to 180 days, and a new provision denying bail to any foreigner who is picked up for terrorist purposes. So I would be very careful that you don't do anything that could be considered, because you can be picked up now by the Indian government without bail as a foreigner in India. Also, it bans any organization that has been banned by the UN, such as the Jamaat-ud-Dawah. And it established a new national investigatory agency. It's been launched, and it has expanded very quickly the Central Industrial Security Force, which is the major counterterrorism force in India. On defense purchases, I only want to say one thing before I finish, and that is that the Congress Party in its manifesto criticized the old BJP government for not spending $6 billion in defense expenditures. Wolf, that would make you happy to hear that, that the new government thinks that spending more money for defense is a good thing. It's estimated that India will spend about $30 billion in defense imports over the next few years. U.S. companies are competing for much of that, including the big $12 billion deal for medium fighter aircraft. However, U.S. law requires, and this is the potential challenge to all this, various types of security arrangements before such arms can be sold. The major one is an end-user agreement. And there have been problems with that, but I think the resolution of that will depend on how much each side is willing to compromise. The U.S. in the past has insisted on on-site inspections, and the Indians have resisted that. I'm, however, confidently told by Mr. Gross that maybe you want to say something afterwards, that we may, in fact, be close to an agreement, that both sides might, in fact, be compromising on the wordings of this. Thank you.
Let me pick up where Walter left off. I want to talk a little bit more about the economy, where I basically very much share Walter's view that what you're likely to see is incremental economic policymaking. There's been a lot of hype about how the return of the Congress with a stronger majority is going to make it possible to really hustle along with economic reform. First of all, the Congress believes, and it may be correct in this belief, that its electoral success owed a lot to things like the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, to its attention to the rural poor. Secondly, even with the dream team fully in place, Manmohan Singh, Chidambaram at Finance, and Montek Singh Ahluwalia heading the Planning Commission, and Ahluwalia, as far as I've been able to determine, is still going to be there, the style of policymaking was quite cautious. The basic approach was, what can we do that isn't going to be shot down? That is an easier test without the government depending on the communists for its survival. But it is still a question that needs to be asked, and that they will be careful in responding. The big difference between this government and the previous one is that no single party can bring it down. And that is a big boost to the self-confidence of the government. Looking ahead on economic performance and policy, one of the big changes over the past 20 years is that there is quite a lot more, if you will, built-in growth potential in the Indian economy. Now, there's two sides to that coin. On the one hand, you've had a significant increase in the percentage of investment that is private and in the percentage of fixed capital formation that is private. On the other hand, when the private sector is in trouble, as with the international economic crisis, that sector is bound to move a little bit more slowly than it has in the past. Walter said that the Congress leadership, or at least the Gandhi family leadership, believes that part of the reason that they haven't suffered more in the economic crisis is that their regulatory system insulates India to some degree from the world economy. However, it is still true that the percentage of their GDP that's devoted to trade, imports plus exports, has increased by, has more than doubled in the past decade. So they are willy-nilly more integrated with the world economy. Their most rapidly growing sector, information technology, now represents about 5% of the economy. That sounds small, but it came from nowhere. And it's a very consequential 5% because it represents a large share of India's foreign exchange earnings. So that while their regulatory system may provide a little bit of ballast, their future growth and their future ability to expand prosperity still depends to a great extent on the international economy and on the private sector. Basically, I would say this is good news both for India and for the United States because it means that there's going to be forces pushing ahead more or less regardless of what the government does. What the government does is going to be, I think, heavily influenced by three tensions in economic policymaking. The first is the one Walter referred to, growth and rural advancement. These are not opposites, but the policies that maximize growth don't maximize rural advancement. So the question is where on that spectrum the needle is going to fall, and most importantly, at what point do the pro-rural poor policies start to become generators of growth? Because depending on how that works, this can actually be a source of growth and of expanding purchasing power down the food chain. The second tension, I would say, is between investment and land use. This isn't necessarily foreign investment. I'm a big believer in the fact that the important thing is investment rather than just foreign investment. But the battles that took place over the establishment of a Tata plant in West Bengal at Shingul, over the establishment of export processing zones, reflect a deep ambivalence about taking land potentially out of agricultural use. Land use is controlled by the states. On the one hand, among the early statements from this government has been a statement that they are going to move ahead on export processing zones. On the other hand, there is considerable ambivalence out there in the areas where lands may be transferred. It's not all resistance. The fight in West Bengal actually was an internal fight as well, to some extent between the politicians and those farmers who thought there were jobs down the road for their kids. So the task of the government is going to be to try again to maximize the employment potential and the degree to which people in different parts of the country are aware of employment opportunities. The third tension is more nebulous. It's between the different kinds of political pull that different kinds of economic growth provide. You have a number of states that have been very successful economically, and I guess the best example of this is Gujarat. They have been successful without having too many explicitly pro-rural poor programs, but they've been successful enough that some of that growth has filtered down, either in the form of jobs that could take young people off the land, or in just plain higher growth. So the issue is not so much politically do we need to grow or not, but once again, in the politics of economic policy, it's can we make the wider benefits visible? Can we create a political packaging as well as a political reality that makes growth attractive? Besides the government of Gujarat under the guy who wants to be the next generation's BJP poster child, Narendra Modi, the governments in Tamil Nadu have been very successful at this. They have spent a lot of time going around and getting photographed at plant openings and taking credit for them. Their popular freebie programs have done relatively non-distorting things like giving away television sets. So there are a number of models in play which may turn out to be interesting. Let me shift gears now and talk a little bit about foreign policy as a lead-in to what Lisa's going to say on India-Pakistan relations. I think the strength of the Congress victory gives the new government as much running room as it could reasonably expect to have on foreign policy. The government that's been reelected, that's been elected, is one that has come to consider the United States its most important external friend. The commitment to strategic autonomy, as Walter said, is as strong as ever. What this means, freely translated, is that no government of India, and I think this represents a consensus across the board, can afford to make it appear that its foreign policy is being dictated by anyone else. And in case you were wondering, that means us. This is probably the biggest challenge that the United States faces in trying to move forward in its partnership with India. I think we have an opportunity to do that. The Indian government is rather nervous about the Obama administration, which it sees as more committed to nuclear nonproliferation of the 1990s variety than the Bush administration was, and less committed to India as a priority than the Bush administration was. And when you add to that the intense focus of this administration on Pakistan and Afghanistan, that increases the nail-biting factor. I think it's too early to start drawing conclusions on that. And I think over the next few months, you're going to see some high-level attention to India, which is going to set the balance in a much better place. I don't see major changes in the pattern of India's foreign relationships. I do see India continuing to regard its economic strength as a source of national power and therefore as a tremendously important element in its foreign policy. In the 1950s and 60s, when Indians said economics were important to foreign policy, they were talking about aid. Today, when Indians make that statement, they're talking about energy, trade, and investment. Very different economic slash foreign policy outlook. Let me, before I pass the baton to Lisa, who's going to talk about what has traditionally been the most sensitive and neuralgic issue in India's foreign policy, also with respect to relations with the United States, let me engage what the Car Talk team would call the Shameless Commerce Division and point out that one of your handouts is a flyer for my book on the future of U.S.-India relations, which will be out in about 2 weeks, and you will all be invited to a book launch party on June 22nd, hold this date, when I will give you the slightly longer version of where I see this going over the longer time. Lisa.
Hey, thank you very much, Tasey, for inviting me here today. It's both an honor and a pleasure to be here with both Tasey and Walter talking about India and the outcome of the elections and the implications for the U.S. I think the re-election of the Congress-led government, as Tasey said, provides an enormous opportunity to build closer U.S.-India ties on a range of issues. Counterterrorism, defense cooperation, as Walter talked about, nuclear nonproliferation, even given some of the differences that might be between our two governments, there's still opportunities, I believe, for cooperation. And I think we're hearing signs that Hillary Clinton may visit India soon. This would be a wonderful opportunity to demonstrate that the U.S. recognizes India as a key partner and maybe overcome some of these suspicions that Tasey had mentioned. But rather than elaborate on those areas, as Tasey mentioned, she's asked me to focus my remarks on Indian policy toward Pakistan in the wake of the elections. Now, I would say despite the continuity in New Delhi and the opportunities that this will bring to strengthen U.S.-Indian ties, the Obama team may need to keep expectations in check regarding any near-term breakthroughs on the Indo-Pakistani dialogue. I think recent editorials in the mainstream U.S. media have interpreted the reemergence of Prime Minister Singh and the Congress Party as providing a mandate for him and the party to resume dialogue with Pakistan. But I believe such analysis may be overly simplistic, and it really fails to acknowledge the genuine Indian security concerns which persist in the aftermath of last November's attacks. And I think it only makes sense, really, for the U.S. to push for a resumption of Indo-Pakistani talks if Washington itself is convinced that Pakistani leaders are pursuing genuine efforts to close down militant groups like the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which, of course, committed the Mumbai attacks. Unfortunately, this week's release of LET leader Hafez Mohammad Saeed has cast doubt over whether Pakistan is moving in this direction. Now, Foreign Secretary Salman Bashir has indicated that the federal courts may appeal the release of Saeed, which I think would help to sort of cool India down and cool the U.S. down. I think the U.S. has demonstrated its unhappiness over this development as well. Now, one might logically conclude that Pakistan's newfound commitment to rooting out the Taliban from Swat Valley might carry over to its resolve to fight militants in other parts of the country, like the LET or the Jaish-e-Mohammed, based mainly in southern Punjab, but also Karachi, Lahore. But I would say that since these groups are still viewed in Pakistan as assets in its dispute with India, it is not yet clear that the Pakistan government will crack down on these militants in the same way. Even though you can certainly make the case that these Punjab-based groups are just as much, if not more, a threat to the Pakistani state. And given the links of these groups to al-Qaeda and international terrorism, it is difficult to understand why any Pakistani leader would conclude that they are anything but a clear and present danger to the stability of the state. I think there's a sense in India that the Pakistan government and people do not fully comprehend the level of anger among Indians over the Mumbai attacks. I recognize that the Mumbai attacks did not significantly influence the elections, but I still think there is an underlying anger over what happened. And I think that they represented a watershed event for many Indians, particularly the elite. The magnitude and sheer audacity of the attacks, the fact that the terrorists entered by sea, which was something very different, the fact that they targeted simultaneously five-star hotels and cafes, the fact that the attacks occurred over a three-day period. And I think, you know, Pakistanis in general need to understand the impact of these attacks on the Indian psyche and the reluctance of India to return to the status quo ante with Pakistan. During his previous tenure, Manmohan Singh obviously spent a significant amount of political capital trying to seal a peace bid with Pakistan under former President Musharraf. Peace talks were conducted through 2004 to 2007 and even survived the massive terror attacks against Mumbai commuter trains in the summer of 2006. Through this dialogue, both sides strengthened mutual confidence, people-to-people exchanges were increased, bilateral trade increased, several cross-border train and bus services were launched, visa regimes were liberalized. So there really, really was significant progress in this period, and we have to remember that. And there was even progress on Kashmir. The two governments seemed to narrow the gap in their rhetoric about an ultimate solution to Kashmir, and both sides referenced the idea of keeping the current boundaries intact, making the line of control irrelevant, and instituting some type of joint mechanism to facilitate cooperation between Pakistani and Indian Kashmir. Unfortunately, I would say India did not take advantage of Musharraf's historic public announcement in December 2006 that Pakistan would, in essence, give up its claim to Kashmir if India granted autonomy to the Kashmiris. I think India assessed that Musharraf was growing weaker politically and would not be able to carry forth his end of the bargain. Of course, New Delhi could have made a different decision, and you know, who knows where we might be today, but such is the history of Kashmir. Whenever one side seems prepared to move forward, the other side, rather than creatively taking advantage of the situation, lets the moment slip away, the conflict persists, And unfortunately, the stakes seem to get higher and higher. The tenor between India and Pakistan will also be impacted by developments inside Kashmir itself. And the situation right now is very fluid. Howard Schaefer is here, and he just launched his book on Kashmir, so I'm sure he'll have many more insights than I have right now in the discussion period. But the way I see it, there was high turnout for last October's state elections. You had a young leader, Omar Abdullah, the son of Farooq Abdullah, elected. And in the national elections just a few weeks ago, longtime separatist leader Sajjad Lone, who is the son of Abdul Ghani Lone, who was murdered in 2002 after attempts to move peace efforts forward. Well, Sajjad Lone, ran in the national elections in Jammu and Kashmir. He didn't win, but that's pretty significant. And from India's perspective, these are positive developments. However, at the same time, we have another prominent separatist leader, Mirwais Umar Farooq, who has said if the new Indian government does not engage Kashmiri leadership or make some headway toward a resolution within the next 2 months, there will likely be street protests and peaceful agitation along the lines of what happened in 2008 over the Amarnath land dispute. This is when street protests broke out last summer over the issue of allotting more land to the Sri Amarnath Shrine Board, which oversees the famous shrine there in northern Kashmir. It's also been the annual pilgrimage to the shrine actually starts on Sunday, and it's a tense time. A lot of times the pilgrims have been targeted in terrorist attacks in the past, and of course we had the situation last year. So we may be headed for some rocky road in Kashmir over the next few weeks, and these are likely to impact the overall Indo-Pakistani dynamics. Now, there has been some strands of positive news in the last few weeks, and I would be remiss if I didn't point these out. The cross line of control bus service was recently opened to all Indians, not just those with relatives living across the line of control. India and Pakistan this week held their annual meeting of the Indus Water Commission on issues related to sharing water resources. And there was a track two meeting of journalists, retired officials, academics. Not that this indicates peace is on the horizon, but I think it does show that the severity of the tensions that were experienced in the immediate aftermath of Mumbai are starting to come down. So in conclusion, I would just say that while Indian officials seem to realize that the risk of fighting a war with Pakistan is quite high, maybe even too high, because of the nuclear factor, they also, and because they realize that would only strengthen the extremist elements in Pakistan, and they are concerned about what's happening in northwest Pakistan. So I think that tempers their reaction to the Mumbai attacks. But they are also increasingly skeptical of the utility of talks with a civilian government when the military seems to still hold the cards in terms of policies toward India and Afghanistan, for that matter. So what can the U.S. do? I think the U.S. needs to quietly find a way to help Pakistani and Indian officials really develop a different security paradigm for the region that allows them to focus on containing dangerous non-state actors that destabilize both countries. We see the beginnings of this happening. The U.S. did have to play a sort of, I don't want to say mediator, but facilitator of communication between the two sides when the level of tension was so high right after Mumbai. I think the U.S. Did play a useful role, did facilitate the sharing of intelligence information. So I think we need to find ways to sort of build on that kind of a role. The U.S. should not, however, try to directly mediate on Kashmir. In the first place, the Indians would not accept such mediation, so it's literally impossible to try to mediate unless you're invited in by both parties. But I think also the U.S. needs to recognize how important it is for Pakistan to deal with the Lashkar-e-Taiba appropriately. This is not only in the interest of Indo-Pakistani peace. It's in the interest of the safety and security of the international community, and that includes Pakistan. So that needs to be the first line of business. And when bilateral Indo-Pakistani talks do resume, I think Washington should encourage both sides to also identify Afghanistan as a key plank in those discussions. This would allow a mechanism for India to make transparent its growing activities in Afghanistan and to solidify trade transit agreements that begin to integrate all three countries, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, economically. I think this is very important. And I think the two sides should be encouraged to pick up the discussions where they left off on Kashmir in 2007, rather than reinventing the wheel. This means Pakistan should not go back to talking about UN resolutions or plebiscites, and India needs to move swiftly to engage the Kashmiri leadership, finding an honorable solution for all involved. And that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Well, thanks to my two colleagues, and this brings us to the fun part of the program. We look forward to hearing from you. Let me ask, I guess I will play traffic cop for this part of the program. Let me ask that you identify yourself, even if I know you, and that you try to make your questions brief so that others can participate. Ravi.
On the one hand, the Obama administration, Ravi Khanna, VOA News. On the one hand, the Obama administration wants India to play a role in resolving the PAC-Afghan problem because of its regional approach. And on the other hand, USA still has to say that the militants on one border are exactly the same as on the other border. The militants on the western border are as dangerous to Pakistan and others as the militants on the eastern border. But the Obama administration has not, they still let Pakistan differentiate between the two. What can U.S. do about it?
Well, yeah, I can't say I disagree with you on that point, and I think that's why I was pointing out in my remarks that I think this is a mistake. I think groups like the Lashkar-e-Taiba do pose a threat to Pakistan itself, and I think many civilian leaders in Pakistan also realize that. But we've got this block, you know, it's almost a mental block within the military establishment that views India as the core national security concern. And so there is a reluctance to do everything possible to rein in these types of groups. And that's, I think, why we saw the release of Hafiz Mohammed Saeed. And it almost seemed like a testing of where the international community would come out on the issue. And I think, you know, the U.S. needs to be very firm that it sees Lashkar-e-Taiba as an international terrorist group, not only a threat to India, but a threat to the international community, as well as Pakistan itself. I think there is debate within the U.S. government of, you know, how much of a direct threat LET is to the U.S. now, perhaps, you know, since there has not been an attack launch, people tend to think it's not possible. But I do think there are people who recognize that it is possible, and there could be an attempt as the U.S. focuses more on the tribal areas in Pakistan and focuses more on this region in general, on Pakistan in general, there could be an attempt by the LET to try to disrupt the U.S.-Pakistan relationship by doing something provocative like it did in Mumbai. I think that is in the realm of possibility. So I think the U.S. needs to tighten up its policy in terms of convincing Pakistan to deal with all of the militants that threaten the region and that threaten Pakistan.
Prakash Ambegaonkar from Beijing Nations. I would like to ask a question, Tezi, to the panel or whoever wants to ask. Each time there are elections in India at the national level, the first thing the press says and everybody all over the world says that we were very surprised. So why is it that polling organizations or the pundits cannot get a more accurate forecast of what is likely to happen? And, for example, what I would like to get from the panel is some feeling of, I just listed three or four major events related to United States relations. What was the role played by the nuclear deal into the elections? The Mumbai attacks, what was the role played by those significant historical events? In terms of the China, for example, the Dalai Lama's news coming up all the time, the Himachal Pradesh or Arunachal Pradesh controversy, and constant fear that China is a threat to the economy of India, and also the BJP screw-ups. If you take at least these four events, how does the panel feel they influenced the elections, and why was it not able to get some conclusion predictions?
I have watched over the years, and India has very good polling organizations, but if you look at their predictions, really going back about 20 years, they have often gotten the national numbers right, but when you look below those, they've gotten state numbers and district numbers completely wrong, which to me says they haven't figured out how to do polling that is going to accurately predict the election. Because if you happen to get the right number by adding up the wrong numbers, it means you don't really have a good predictive mechanism. A lot of the analysts who were predicting the election in advance were trying to discern national trends. I'm skeptical about the importance of national trends, although I did speak to a retired Indian official yesterday who is convinced that one of the reasons that the Congress came back stronger was that there was, at the national level, some desire for stability of government and continuity post-Mumbai. We'll never know which of us is right. I would therefore say, though, that most of the issues you mentioned did not play much of a role in the election. The possible exception to that may be the disarray within the BJP. Walter?
There we go. Why are they wrong? I think you're right. I think, you know, they haven't sort of figured out how to ask the right questions in a population that's still somewhat suspicious, particularly in rural India. Someone comes to you with shirt, tie, and all of that, and you think he's a government official. He says, who are you going to vote for? You'll likely say, I'm going to vote for whoever's in power now, or say nothing. So it's hard to get around that, and I think that's probably cultural more than anything else, as you well know. And so I doubt if you're ever going to get all that accurate statistic. You may get more in urban areas, but even there I have some doubts about. On issues, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people call this an issue-less election. I'm not sure that's true. You didn't have sort of the big wave kind of issues, and I totally agree with Tazer. The issues you mentioned didn't seem to play all that much of a role. But there was some that did. People said that identity issues didn't seem to play as large a role, and that's reflected in the statistics on regional and caste parties that did worse. Chief ministers who had competent governments, the parties that they belonged to, did well. If you look at the statistics and look at the states here, even states where, you know, BJP, Karnataka, BJP, BJP, hold, they got, you know, that huge block in the south of BJP victory, that's Karnataka. Why did they increased their percentages in Karnataka. Why did they do that? Because they had a very competent chief minister. Why did the BJP and its ally in Bihar do very well, and the Congress did almost nothing in Bihar? Is you had a very competent chief minister. Madhya Pradesh, BJP did relatively well. Why did it do well? Because they had a competent chief minister. I think the issue of competence, people are looking for results, and I think that counts. And at least if you look at maybe when we get another Steve Wilkinson study, we'll find out whether they did or not. But at least for politicians and press, they're now saying that people are looking for results. And so politicians, I think, are going to be more alert to the issue of providing services for people. And to my view, that's a positive.
Lisa, do you want to add?
Just to say, I think I agree with Tazi's point that it probably shows a desire for stability in sort of uncertain times. But it is quite interesting that the Mumbai attacks themselves didn't figure prominently. The communal issues, Pakistan didn't figure. It was mostly, it seemed to me, local economic development or maybe governance issues. But I think that says a lot for Indian democracy and its development.
Can I add one thing? However, the talk about Pakistan and that, the government took a very hard line. Its new law and what it did across the board, so it's not as if you could, you know, in fact, they moved fast to take a hard line because they were afraid that they could be punished for what was plainly an incompetent response to the Mumbai attacks. And so they took a hard line, and they had taken a hard line on Pakistan as a state I mean, the comments. Look at the reaction to the release of Saeed. I mean, this is not just a diplomat. I mean, this was a hard-punching reaction almost all the way through the political system in India on that.
Well, thank you very much, and Lisa, thank
my name,
rank, and serial number, or social security number. I'm Howard Schaefer. I'm connected with this lady, and I teach at Georgetown University. And I appreciate Lisa's remarking my book, which has just come out, on Kashmir. Its title is America's Role in Kashmir, the Limits of Influence. For sale by the Brookings Institution.
Is that 10% off? You buy it here.
And, and I urge you all to take a look at it, even to buy it. I want to pick up on something that Lisa has said about the elections in the national election as it was held in Jammu and Kashmir. And it seems to me that there's always been a tendency on the part of the powers in India to look at the bright side of political developments in Jammu and Kashmir, and that includes election results. This kind of interpretation, it seems to me, leads to a certain degree of self-satisfaction and an understanding or misunderstanding about what the election means for the fundamental issue of the historic Kashmir dispute. And I think that may happen this time. It seems to me the Indians will see the big turnout, certainly bigger than in the past, the willingness of at least some of the separatist leaders to take part in the election, the success of the National Conference, the local government party and Congress in the returns as indication that, well, things are going well. There really is no reason to make any further compromises. The problem, in short, is on its way to solution. Now, this could change. I mean, if these demonstrations are successfully mounted, this feeling of confidence could be quickly dissipated. But it seems to me that right now, that's probably the governing sentiment in New Delhi.
No, I think that's correct. I think that's right. I think, you know, there is a, but I think it's tentative. I think, yeah, they know there's the potential. They're worried about something like what happened last summer. I mean, these were massive protests in 2008. They are worried about that happening again. You know, although they see the high turnout for elections even after that happened is positive. So that's what I'm saying. The situation is sort of fluid. There's a lot of different things happening at the same time. But, you know, I want to make the point, though, that how much the Mumbai attacks don't have to do with Kashmir. I mean, if you look at really what's happening in Kashmir and the Kashmiris, I don't think they did not support. I think they were deeply offended and disturbed by the Mumbai attacks. So I think the idea that somehow what happened in November in Mumbai was related to what's really happening on the ground in Kashmir, I just don't see it. I don't see the linkages. I think that the attacks in Mumbai were much broader. I think they were an attempt to sort of undermine India more broadly, to put a dent in its sort of emerging power status and reputation, and really just very little to do with some of the trends we see in Kashmir. Certainly the Kashmiris are looking for some kind of better deal in India, But I don't think it's correct to connect what we saw in Mumbai with the situation in Kashmir.
Wolf Gross with Northrop Grumman, a company that's increasingly interested in and working in the opportunities for defense cooperation with India. I guess this is beat up on Lisa time. Lisa, I want to focus your attention on your bilateral indication of things that can be done, India-Pakistan, by the U.S. government, and sound a note of caution and get your comment. Trilateral. The old great game seems to be alive and well. You've got the Indians fiddling around in Afghanistan, for want of a better term. Actually, it's much more constructive than that. They are helping with, as far as we can tell, helping with reconstruction or construction, since there was not much to be reconstructed in Afghanistan. And then the Pakistan part of the equation. For the U.S. government, you've got three sovereign governments involved, none of which is particularly friendly with either of the other two. And I'd like your comments on how the U.S. government can or should wend its way through this minefield.
Well, I think the administration has begun to wend its way through the minefield by trying to promote closer Afghan-Pakistan ties. And so you have that trilateral discussion that's happening between the U.S., Pakistan, Afghanistan, and efforts to improve border trade, improve cooperative mechanisms to control the border. And you very much have an opportunity, because I think President Karzai and President Zardari do have sort of a personal chemistry. And you even see in the foreign ministries, particularly in Pakistan, wanting to sort of try to improve the relations. Now, in terms of bringing India in, I do think India is part of this, because India wants access to Afghanistan. It wants to be able to transit its goods through Pakistan. And if you're really going to have success in developing the region, then you do need to have more cooperation. So I think there is room for doing more to promote Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, sort of economic projects or cooperation or even just discussions. And I think if there's a way to bring in the private sector, this would be optimal. I think, beyond any kind of government-to-government discussions, I think bringing the private sector is key.
Yeah, I think the way to approach the Pakistani concern about Indian involvement in Afghanistan is through Pakistan and India itself. There's enormous suspicion, I think most of it unfounded, that the Indians are meddling in Pakistan. They're doing all sorts of nefarious things, and they're up to no good, partly based on precedent there. The key to that, India and Pakistan, however, is the terrorism issue. If there's another attack by LET or any other Pakistan-based organization, then all bets are off, and relations will be sour for years. India may then begin to muck around in Afghanistan, to be quite frank. I think what we've got to do is we've got to be much tougher than we've been so far in insisting that these organizations, it's to the well-being of Pakistan that crackdown, these organizations take place. Far more dangerous than Taliban, I agree with Lisa, are these groups in South Punjab, who are now the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, the Lashkar-e-Taiba. Where incidentally, if what I read is correct, all 10 of the attackers in Mumbai are from South Punjab, recruited by the Lashkar-e-Taiba. Because they threaten what is the critical state in Pakistan, and you've got a situation in South Punjab which you combine religious fanaticism with social revolution. And South Punjab is feudal, and the feudals are Shia, not Sunni. And you get sort of urban shopkeepers who are sort of seeking authority, and they're turning to religious fundamentalism to do so. I think it's important that we put pressure on Pakistan to crack down on these groups, because that, in some ways, is the key to Afghanistan, in my view. because unless that happens, you know, and you talk about Kashmir, the reports in the Indian press are that cross-border infiltration is up and violence in Kashmir is up. Whether the Pakistan government can do anything about that, if it's true, my guess is it probably is. Something more has to be done to crack down on these groups. Another sign, who were the major charitable organizations in the camps? Who were they? The Jamaat-ud-Dawah. Last I heard, the Jamaat-ud-Dawah is supposed to be banned. Yeah, it's banned. It's a clone of the LET. It was the major group providing charity work in the camps. And it's been reported in all the American press. Everyone has seen it. Why? Why hasn't this organization been stamped out or an effort made in that direction? Because until it is, it will not be improved India-Pakistan relations, and to expand it then to Afghanistan, the Afghanistan issue is going to remain a problem between India and Pakistan, I think.
Burgess, George.
I know this Kashmir issue has been a major drain on the resources of both countries. Is there any estimate in terms of economic cost?
Let me take that one.
Having this Kashmir issue. Secondly, what is the military militaries of both countries? What is the strategic importance of the location of Kashmir to both militaries?
The economic cost, if you mean what governments are spending that they otherwise wouldn't have to spend, is actually not that great. If Kashmir had been at peace for the past 60 years, there are subsidy programs that India probably wouldn't have had to maintain. The same is true on the Pakistan side. But none of this is breaking the bank. The economic cost that is significant is the one that's hardest to mobilize. It's the opportunity cost. You may have seen the study I did on the economics of peace building in Kashmir. It's about 3 years old. And basically, we identified a number of areas that could significantly improve the economy with probably not much government outlay. But the problem is that insecurity and bad relations between India and Pakistan make it hard to move in that direction. As for the strategic importance, this is a subject on which you get a lot of very emotive talk. All of the significant headwaters of the Indus run through Kashmir at some point, so for both sides they are strategic. And since Pakistan is in general more water short and is in general downstream of India, they feel it more keenly. There is the fact that Kashmir, for significant parts of its extent, sits between India or Pakistan and China. And, of course, China has a small and relatively unpopulated piece of the old princely state. I would suggest, though, that the strategic importance could be managed if the politics could.
Okay. I just want the implications of Indo-U.S. defense cooperation of the new election.
In the back.
Thank you, Ambassador Schaefer. I'm Joanne Thornton. I'm with Concept Capital's Washington Research Group. And just a quick question on trade policy, picking up on what Ambassador Schaefer said about the future growth prospects of India being so dependent on the global economy. And yet, everything else you talked about, particularly the attention to the rural poor. I'm just wondering if this election is any kind of a game changer with respect to the Doha round, particularly since we have a new commerce minister in place. Thank you.
I actually have spent some time with the new commerce minister. He's a personable, able, and articulate guy. He isn't carrying the baggage of all the previous Doha round negotiations. I'm hesitant to say that this is a game changer, however, because the fundamental problem in the Doha round is that India has not seen that much benefit to itself from a successful Doha round. And in those circumstances, it's been understandably quite reluctant to make the political, to take the political risks involved in opening up its agricultural market. And that was the issue that brought things to a close before. So you have a chance to restart the negotiations without too much of the scratchiness of what went before, but you still have this fundamental obstacle to get over. The gentleman in the blue tie.
Thank you, yes, sir. Kevin Massey with the Brookings Institution. My question is on energy security. And given the projections for limitless or unending growth in energy demand in India and its continued import dependence for energy resources, what are the implications, if any, of the renewed mandate for the Congress Party for regional, bilateral, and multilateral deals in the field of energy security?
I think that one's mine, too. India is the second fastest growing energy market in the world after China. The prospects for its becoming less import dependent are approximately zero. There are various estimates of how much its import needs are going to grow over the next few years. The recent estimates are probably on the high side because growth has slowed down, but there's going to be a plus sign in front of that number regardless. The Congress government has wanted, and as like for example, for that matter, its opponents in the BJP, everybody has wanted to develop more regional energy arrangements. The first effort was the idea of gas pipelines from Bangladesh. That basically foundered on the rock of Bangladeshi politics. India is the big neighbor everyone loves to hate on the Bangladeshi political scene. Think about gringos in Latin America. The other has been this idea of a pipeline from Iran through Pakistan to India, which the Iranian and Pakistani parts have supposedly been agreed now, although I wish I had a nickel for every time that they had been agreed. And one hears as a small footnote that they haven't agreed on the price. If they haven't agreed on the price, there isn't an it yet. But the interesting thing here, I mean, there are three interesting things. First of all, I think no Indian government is going to kill off that idea because their strategy for energy is diversify, diversify, diversify. And however many other concerns they may have about the agreement, they're not going to say no to any arrangement that might diversify their sources of energy. Secondly, and on the other hand, this sucker has a lot of hands, there are deep concerns in India about any arrangement to import a strategic commodity across Afghanistan, across Pakistan, especially when you consider that it would have to cross Baluchistan with all of the domestic turmoil that that involves. My own view is that that could be managed, but it could only be managed in the context of better India-Pakistan relations. So you have to have a certain baseline improvement in order to get to the point where this piece of infrastructure becomes part of the ballast that moves India-Pakistan relations in a positive direction. And the third interesting observation is the U.S. attitude. The Obama administration has, as far as I'm aware, not said anything about the pipeline. The Bush administration had taken a strong position against it in its discussions with India, but never said much to the Pakistanis about it, a fact that did not escape India's notice. In fact, when Bush went to Islamabad in 2006 and was asked about the pipeline at a press conference, the answer he gave was, we're not opposed to the pipeline per se. And, of course, the minute he got back to Washington, you started hearing senior unnamed people at the National Security Council saying, well, what my boss meant to say was, I don't know whether the U.S. will continue to take as hard a line against it. I suspect that that is something that will depend in part on where our relations go with Iran. I think, actually, that this proposal has a lot of basic commercial problems and that the chances of its coming to fruition are poor. How important is this for India's energy dependence? Again, it's an opportunity cost question, although there are doubts about whether Iran is in fact going to be a reliable supplier. And the other ideas for regional cooperation tend to be fairly mushy. I think that it's going to be hard to put anything regional together, and that a great one step that could be taken that would be very useful would be to find a way to bring both India and China into the International Energy Agency, and the mechanics of that go well beyond the scope of this meeting.
I want to go, Ray Vickery from Wilson Center. I want to go back to a comment that Dr. P made earlier, and that is about whether we had any idea what was really happening in Indian politics. Mark Twain once said, "I can predict anything but the future." And that certainly seems to have been the case in regard to this election. And it's not just a matter of polling. I know of no nonpartisan commentator, academic or otherwise, in this country or in India who predicted this outcome. It's an amazing development. And from an academic point of view, it shows the needs in terms of being able to understand better what is actually happening in India. Second, Dr. P raised the questions about the nuclear deal, Mumbai, and China fear, and the basic answer was, well, those didn't play a role here. I think that underestimates the significance of the dog that doesn't bark, because the fact that they did not become issues which were widely debated, I think to me is very significant. In regard to the nuclear deal, I don't think there's any question that the far left and others who had opposed the deal would tried to make something out of this at the early, but it got no traction at all. To me, that's very significant. That indicates that the U.S.-India relationship is on a very strong footing in terms of its political acceptability and saliency, and I think we'd make a mistake not to recognize the opportunity that that presents for the Obama administration and for U.S.-India relations generally. Similarly, in regard to the attacks on Mumbai, there's no question that BJP went all out in terms of what happened last November to make a political issue out of this which would kill the Congress party. And they even called for the immediate resignation of the prime minister. That got them nowhere, not because people weren't mad and people weren't upset, but because they recognized that that was overreaching and that they recognized that you needed a better approach to it, that you needed a more rational approach than just striking out. I think that's a remarkably positive development in terms of the Indian electorate and what happens there. And I think you could even make the same argument in regard to what happens with China and the Chinese are going to run us all out of business because of cheap goods and so forth. So I think those are very important. One question that I would like to raise again is the question about the rural poor and development. I think that the Congress, UPA, is widely interpreting the line which they took as being very important in that. And I happen to think, even though I'm not sure and be interested in what the panel has to say again about this, whether there is data that support this or not, but certainly not only the business about employment, in rural employment, but the whole question of loan forgiveness and what Chidambaram did in the last budget and the way that was received seems to have had a very strong political effect in terms of that. And I don't know that you necessarily judge that effect by saying that there's not much difference in terms of results between rural poor and urban. That I happen to think that those things, the whole development question, goes together. And just lastly, on the question about Doha, I do believe that this can be a game changer in regard to Doha. And the reason is, I think there's a split within the Congress leadership, with Sonia on one side taking a more traditionally socialistic approach, and the Prime Minister really on another side, liking to see it to go forward. And I don't think that it's by chance that Kamal Nath has gone down to take care of surface transportation, whereas Anand Sharma, who has a long history of a very intensive involvement in international matters with South Africa and across the board, has been put in that position. I don't think that solves the question of what happens in Doha, but I do think it presents an opening which is very significant. But back to the question, I'd be very interested again in what is the view of the panel in regard to this question about rural development versus urban, and what effect that's had.
I'm going to hold that question and ask Ravi Khanna to have the last word as far as questions are concerned, and then the panel will...
Yeah, I just wanted to know the implications of this election on Indo-U.S. defense cooperation. You talked about strategic autonomy being the mantra. How is it going to affect the defense partnership?
The defense partnership has moved forward really quite steadily. Steadily includes a lot of bureaucratic delays, but that's part of the system. And it until the last year and a half or so, it attracted remarkably little controversy on the Indian scene. It became controversial at the time that the nuclear deal was becoming controversial. The only people who were passionate in the controversy department were the communists, who tried and failed to bring down the government. So I think that the election, again, has given Manmohan Singh and his government as much running room as they could reasonably expect to have. I don't expect to see the bureaucratic issues melt away into nothing. But I think that things are going to go ahead. And I'm fascinated by this Congress policy statement that berates the BJP for not spending all that money. It is true that for a number of years, the Indian government underspent its defense budget, and specifically underspent its defense purchases budget.
Walter
and I would encourage you also to pick up Ray's questions. And then Lisa will have the last word.
Let me go real quickly from the end on defense. The leadership and this, you know, especially the Prime Minister and Rahul Gandhi, Chidambaran, and you know, have a very favorable view for close relations with the U.S. I think the reason we're getting closer on what is the very difficult issue of end-user agreements is both sides are willing to compromise, because they think it's important for the relationship to compromise. And if you're right, Wolf, you know, we may be quite close indeed to something, and I hope you're right about that. So I hope that answers, because I think what you have is a leadership there that really wants to move, and to a certain extent it depends on the U.S. now to come up creatively with ways how to make use of that. On rural poor, you're right. I mentioned one of the programs, which is about $10 billion a year, and that's the job program. There's also the debt forgiveness, which is another $10 billion program. And they're now thinking of extending that. That program only applied to bank debt. They're now thinking that applying that to private debt, which would be an administrative nightmare to figure that one out. But I think they're going to try, because I think they see this as important. This could have positive consequences for development. because you put more money in the hands of people who will spend most of that money on consumer goods of one kind or another. And in fact, people are talking about the next big push in Indian development is likely to be in rural India with agro-industry. Already in a whole range of industries, the majority of purchases are taking place in rural India. I'm told that the Nano car has sold more cars in rural India than it has in urban India. So I think that's a sign, a good sign of where the next big push in development is very likely to be, is in rural India. Certainly politically, they're going to get a lot of help from the politicians. The Congress Party thinks it won because of the rural vote, and they're going to push investment in rural areas. So if anything, you're going to have a lot of things working together to push up the rural situation. On the on the election statistics and why it's so hard, you had 700 million people vote in India. You have a country of 26 languages, one of the most amazingly complex countries in the world, but more importantly, a country that's now undergoing a significant social change. How are you going to sort of catch what's happening, the complexity with thousands of variables and what's happening in a country this large, this complex, where enormous social change is happening? I'm not surprised that they don't get it wrong. I'm surprised they don't get it even more wrong than they have in the past. This is very difficult to do, given the nature of the country you're dealing with. This is, in some ways, perhaps of any country in the world, this is the one that's most on the move in terms of change.
Lisa?
Yeah, just a couple of points. First, I need to compliment Walter, because several weeks ago, before the outcomes of the elections came out, we had a program, and he was on the mark. He predicted Congress. Yeah, I'm coming to him. The next elections, I'm asking Walter, because he didn't give numbers. I think probably the numbers stunned us all, the fact that Congress, you know, got over 200 seats, but he certainly thought it would be another Congress-like government, and we had an Indian interlocutor who was predicting a third or fourth front. And 2 days before the election results came out, I met with an Indian official who thought the Congress would probably win but get, you know, close to the 145, 150 marker of seats. So I don't think anybody predicted the level of the win, but Walter was close. On defense cooperation, just real quick, I want to commend to you an op-ed by the U.S. Pacific Commander, Admiral Keating, who recently visited India and published an article in the Indian press talking about the opportunities for India and the U.S. to partner to promote stability in Asia, particularly through maritime cooperation in the Indian Ocean region. So I think we can be pretty optimistic about the future of U.S.-India defense cooperation for several reasons. I think, number one, that's always been the area where we've had the most traction in terms of moving the relationship forward. So it's got a good track record. Number two, the leftist parties, which had been the ones really objecting to, you know, sort of the very overt U.S.-India defense cooperation, are no longer a factor, or very little factor. And number three, I think U.S. military leaders are beginning to develop more of a strategic view in terms of India's role in the region, and that bodes well for seeing the defense relationship move forward.
Yeah, can I make one point about that? I think the one area where we should move immediately is on working, cooperating in some way with the Indians on Indian Ocean sea lane protection. There are now no agreements on that. And with the surge in problems of piracy and the ever-present sort of terrorism problems, just plain accidents as more ships are there, there's no coordinated mechanism. India has the only indigenous blue water navy and is building it up. Most Indian trade goes by sea. It has a reason to protect those sea lanes, and I think we should begin to cooperate with it and let it take the lead in doing something, because I think that's an immediate area where he's going to get immediate results. It's win-win. It's good for us. It's good for them. It's good for a lot of other people, too.
Well, thank you all for coming, and we hope to see you back again on our airline at an early opportunity.